book of Proverbs doesn't do that. It's not a story, but it's a compilation of adages, sayings, teachings that are all valuable and important to us, but they are not necessarily grouped in any certain way. You may have a passage that says something to a young man and how he interacts with a woman, paired next to someone, you know, the fool does this, and, you know, totally different things. You know, there's a lot of different topics covered in the book of Proverbs. So we will be grouping them according to topics and looking at that. When I organize material, I am most comfortable tying it together with a story as well. So when we organize this, we're going to look at examples. I'm a very visual person. I tend to try to paint stories and tell stories and paint pictures for people. So when we do these studies of the individual topics, we're going to go and look at other examples in the Bible of individuals that either exhibited the topic that we're describing or some other type of example that will help it make it more relatable to our everyday life. So that's the kind of the outline of the approach. Your teachers this quarter will be myself, Brother Burns, when he's able to. Backup teachers are, but I'm glad that we're able to have the study. It's been a while since I've actually sat in on a study on Proverbs, and there's a lot of wisdom in this crowd, so as we go into the wisdom literature, jump in and add to it. So the theme of the of Proverbs, as we get into the book, is one that is particularly pointed out in verses 1 and 7. It says, "The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge." And when we think about when a passage says the fear of the Lord, what might that bring? What's that? Okay. Ezekiel and how the children of Israel should have been fearful of the Lord and what he was going to bring as to judgment upon the people. What characteristics of God set him apart from other beings such that we should fear him? Creator. Okay, creator of everything. He is all-powerful. He's all-knowing. He's omnipresent. He's everywhere, so he's all-seeing. So when we think about that, if we are going about our day-to-day lives and we're only concerned about the people around us, do we really fear that everybody will find out if we do something wrong? No, because they're not necessarily present. But God, on the other hand, is ever-present and knows every thought and intent of our hearts as we go through this. So the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. If we apply that to our lives, it guides us in every step that we do, because we know that he is with us on every basis and every decision. Looking at 9 and 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. When we look at the Bible, and particularly as we look at these Proverbs, as we go forward in the fear of the Lord, it's going to drive us to make our decisions, if we apply it that way. But the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. God's given us his word to teach us. These Proverbs will teach us many things. The book of Proverbs is in a group of literature called wisdom literature. Start Psalms, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, Song of Solomon, Job as well. And with that, much of the ancient cultures had wisdom literature. You know, they had smart people that had experienced things and were wise in their sayings. So this is not uncommon for a culture to have wisdom literature. God chose through the Israelites to record this for our benefit. But he makes the, Solomon continues in the book of Ecclesiastes in 12, 13 through 14, says, "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man." So Solomon, as we're going to look into some of our characteristics of the author later in our study today, makes the point that through all of his experiences, the final conclusion that he comes to is that the whole duty of man is to fear God and keep his commandments. Now, when we look at guiding principles in our lives, that's a pretty good starting point, isn't it? If every day when we wake up, we tell ourselves we're going to fear God and keep His commandments, that's a really good starting point. And it's a premise for all Christians and all people that are interested in serving God to start with on a daily basis. So the theme of Proverbs is to fear the Lord. He's the beginning of knowledge. So the book of Proverbs by itself is not written by one author. Solomon, vast majority of the Proverbs. But there are some other contributors. Solomon, if we look at the majority of the book, verse 1 through chapter 1, 1 through 22, 16, and then 25 through the end of 29. There's a section in between that that was accounted to miscellaneous wise men. Agur, and there's not a lot said about who he is other than he's a wise man, did chapter 30. King Lemuel is attributed with chapter 31, which is the worthy woman passage. So if we're looking at those, it's a group of wise men of that day, but it's not all attributed to Solomon. Solomon is attributed with over 3,000 proverbs. That's a lot of proverbs. Now why, as we go now into primary author and King Solomon, what do you know about Solomon that makes sense as to why he was so able to write so many proverbs? He asked God for wisdom. And what did God do? He gave it to him. And why did God choose to give him wisdom? He asked for it. Okay. Solomon, God asked Solomon, what one thing can I give you? Now, most kings of that day would look at, okay, and by common wisdom of a king that's leading a nation, what things are important to a leader? Peace, wealth, stability, influence. All of those things are important to a leader in a nation to be able to keep control of that nation. So if you were in Solomon's position and you were a leader of the day, you might have asked for one of those. It would have been a common thing to ask for. He, however, asked for wisdom. And that shows and points to character in the individual. Solomon was the son of who? David. What characteristic is said about David? He's a man after God's own heart. However, David was so wanted to do one thing for God in Jerusalem. And what was that? Build the temple. And he was not allowed to. Why? Because he was a man of war. Okay. Solomon was appointed to that task. And David prepared him through his life, no doubt through training and through teaching, to be prepared to be the one that's going to build the temple. The timing of the writings of Solomon obviously would have been at the end of the United Kingdom, and his writings would have been recorded then. However, the book itself was not compiled until sometime in the day of Hezekiah. So, much like he may have written a number of things, the book itself was compiled into a book in its form in the day of Hezekiah. The condition of Israel at the time of Solomon was one of wealth, power, and influence. It's during the United Kingdom. It's at the peak of the United Kingdom. David brought stability. Solomon brought influence, not necessarily through the best means. We know Solomon had his flaws. What are some of his key flaws? Foreign women. Way too many wives. And they influenced him to do evil in his latter days, worshiping their gods. And I think that's one of the reasons that he makes the point in the passage in Ecclesiastes, where he sums it all up as he is experiencing the wisdom of his life, saying the sum of the duty of man is to fear God and keep his commandments. Why did Solomon record these proverbs? Well, if we look at, he was wise. He needed to influence his people. His personal experiences would have led him to learn things and record them for the people to not experience some of the pitfalls that he had and try and dodge them. As we go into this, we're going to talk about what a proverb is. It's going to be real easy to help us understand that a proverb is kind of like a small thing that we can hang on to. Leadership. Solomon was one of the wisest men of his day. And his influence in the region brought wise men from all over and leaders and queens. And we know the Queen of Sheba visited to experience his wisdom and his wealth. So his leadership was one of the things that caused him to record these for not only the children of Israel, but his writings would have scattered throughout the world. So what is a proverb? Now, if you look at Webster's, it's going to say it's a short, pithy saying. Pithy's not a word I use every day, so I've changed this around. It's a concise and often forceful expression of a general truth or piece of advice. And if you look at some of our modern examples of proverbs, you know, that's, and I know that text has got to be small. It's not so small up there. It's really tiny on that screen. A stitch in time saves nine. Okay, today we don't relate to that near as much. How many people still sew or mend their clothes? Most of us don't, but let's say when that was probably put out in the early 1700s, people still made their own clothes. And if you wanted to preserve a article of clothing, you mended it immediately rather than let it tear and get worse. Okay. A penny saved is a penny earned. How many people have heard that? You know, these are kind of sayings and proverbs that just, you know, kind of resonate with us. We've heard them all of our life. And they fit almost an apple a day turns the doctor away or takes the doctor away. These are things that we've heard our parents say, our other people say, and they stick with us. We'll tell our kids these same things. Whether that, you know, it's one of those observations. In the realm of trying to put information in front of people, marketers know so well how to couch information and put it in front of people to be able to get them to think on it. And for years, they've used very different things, whether it's mass media campaigns or whether it's short sayings that just resonate. How many of you remember jingles from early in your life? It's not used so much today, but the Oscar Mayer Wiener jingle. Yeah, I could sing that all day long and know it. And some of these others that are written, okay, some of these sayings fit in that same category because once we hear them, they don't just disappear. And so that's the beauty of a proverb. It's a short thing. It stays with us. It's concise. And it's generally like, wow, that makes so much sense. Why didn't I think of that? As we go forward, King Solomon, what made Solomon uniquely qualified? We talked about the fact that Solomon asked for and is granted wisdom in 1 Kings 3 and 5. Solomon's wisdom was displayed. And let's look at 1 Kings 3. Because I think it's important for us to look at, you know, how the people around him recognized his wisdom and how he exhibited it, why he would be uniquely qualified to put together a set of teachings so common like this. If you were to be asked one particular thing regarding the story of Solomon that exhibited his wisdom, what would be the one expression of his wisdom that would immediately come to mind? Okay, divining the truth between the two women and the dead child. And that is recorded in 1 Kings 3. Let's see. At the end of chapter 3, and it begins in verse 16. And I think it's important to read this story because it puts together the preface of the information of how Solomon was uniquely qualified. It says, there came two women that were harlots unto the king and stood before him. And the one woman said, O Lord, I and this woman dwell in one house, and I delivered a child with her in the house. And it came to pass the third day after I had delivered that this woman delivered. And also, and we were together, and there was no stranger with us in the house, and save we two in the house. Okay, so she's telling a story to him and helping him understand what's about to happen. Verse 19, and this woman's child died in the night because she smothered it. She overlaid it. And she arose in the midnight, took my son from beside me, and while an handmaid slept, laid it in her bosom, and her dead child in my bosom. And when I arose in the morning to nurse my child, behold, it was dead. And when I had considered it in the morning, behold, it was not my son, which I did bear. And the other woman said, nay, but the living is my son, and the dead is thy son. And this said, no, but the dead is thy son, and the living not my son. Thus they spake before the king. Solomon's presented with a story. And if we go back to some of the lessons that we had while David Banning was here, they've told themselves a story about what's to happen. And now Solomon, with no evidence, has to discern between the two women and where this child has to go. This is not an easy task. Is there any evidence or verifiable third parties? No, so it wouldn't hold up. We couldn't define it in our court system, could we? You know, they'd have to do a DNA evidence test, and that didn't exist at that time frame. So what did Solomon do? He said, take the child and divide it in half and give it to half of it to each of the women. What immediate response did that prompt? The rightful mother of that child did not want it to die. And what was the reaction of the other woman? She was for it. Divide the child. How callous is that? That was a wise way of setting up a situation to discern between. It's almost an interrogation technique, was it not? But it's not something that we think about. I wouldn't have thought about doing that. It's not something I'm trained in doing. Solomon, because of the wisdom he was given by God, was able to use a technique and an approach to discern the truth. And the fame of that story carries with us all the way through to today, because when we asked you what one story stands out, that's the one that was mentioned. Think about that story spreading throughout the entire world, local world at that time, about what Solomon was capable of doing. So, from a uniquely qualified standpoint, this is some of the evidence that we know. We talked about to whom did the child belong. We talk about in 1 Kings 2, we're going to see the exercising of Solomon's wisdom in 1 Kings 2. Now, this precedes, 1 Kings 2 somewhat precedes the request for wisdom, but we don't know chronologically exactly when he requested the wisdom. But I think it's interesting to see how he responded in 1 Kings 2 to the situation that surrounded him with respect to the transition from David's kingdom to his. When David was on his deathbed and basically handed over power, were there other brothers that wanted to lay claim to the power as well, the throne? There were. And other brothers that were probably older, other brothers that didn't necessarily have a situation surrounding them as to what existed between David and Bathsheba. So we see throughout the entire passage of chapter 2, different things that are set in motion, some of which David advises Solomon on in advance of his death. At the end of David's reign, he had to flee Jerusalem, did he not? Because of Absalom's rebellion. And when he did that, there was one particular guy that came out and derided him as he left the city because of his taking over from King Saul. Does anybody remember that gentleman's name? Shimei. Okay. What did David say about Shimei? Told his son to avenge him, did he not? Solomon basically set up and said to Shimei, you're not going to leave the city. If you do leave the city, you will be killed. He didn't take his life, but he set conditions that would control his influence so he was not throughout the kingdom spreading disparaging issues and creating problems for Solomon. The brother that was also a threat to some degree, what did he actually have done to him? He had him killed. What about the leader of the armies? Joab. He had him killed. And put together and consolidated his power under a leader that was loyal to him. And we don't necessarily think about it in this way, but this storyline here in chapter 2, telling what he did to consolidate his power, is actually very wise if you're trying to create a stable kingdom that is not going to be an issue. Now, did Solomon just do those things out of spite and hate and so on? No. Each one of those individuals rightfully deserved to be killed. Joab, because of the way that he had killed Amasa. Some of the other things associated with what had been asked for. You know, his brother asking for one of David's concubines. That is, you know, that's the kind of steps that Solomon took to consolidate his power. His fame. Talking about his wisdom on display. In 1 Kings 4 and 29 through 34. It says, and God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding exceeding much, and largeness of heart, even as the sand that is on the seashore. And Solomon's wisdom excelled the wisdom of all the children of the east country. Now, to the east would have been what regions? Babylon. Babylon was known for its wise people. And sometimes when we think about the east, we forget that that's also considered to be the area of the oldest civilizations. Where did Abraham come from? He came from Ur of the Chaldees, which was way to the east of where Israel is, and down in the Fertile Crescent. They had to come up over the Fertile Crescent, come down into the land of Canaan. So to the east would have been that area. Even further east, in those days, would have been the wisdom of India, the wisdom of China. We don't have that recorded in the Bible as examples there, but that would have also existed. In the rest of this passage here, it talks about it exceeded the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than them all. Certain key men were mentioned here because they were famous within their nations. He spoke 3,000 proverbs. His songs were 1,005. It's interesting to note in the next verse that it talks about not only just wisdom, but he talked about things that were, to some degree, I'm guessing, were scientific in nature. It says he talked about the trees. He spake of the trees from the cedar tree that is Lebanon, even unto the hyssop, springing out of the wall, also of beasts and of fowl and of creeping things and fish. He had wisdom given to him by God that would have been invaluable to an early biologist, would it not? A botanist. These are the things he's talking about here. If we break it down into the category of this, he knew things that nobody else knew in that time. And there came of all the people to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all the kings of the earth which had heard of his wisdom. His fame spread throughout to where people came to him to learn all of this wisdom. No doubt, Solomon would have told them where it came from. Was his wisdom within him only? No, it was given to him by God. That influence then spreads to these other nations as well, as a point of respect and a point of recognition for God that would not have existed in those countries. His wealth. How wealthy was Solomon? Now, we know he asked for wisdom. Because he asked for wisdom, God gave him wealth and peace in his kingdom. Now, when we start to think about the wealth of Solomon, anybody got any points of reference to kind of give an idea of what that was? One of the passages talks about the trade that went on and how much gold came into the land of Canaan on a yearly basis. 660 tons. That's an exorbitant amount of gold. We know from the recording of the history of the building of the temple, how was the temple done on the inside? It was gold overlay on wood. What were the fixtures and the vessels made of within the temple? They were gold. Now, a lot of this David had set aside to begin with, so in preparation for that. But immense amounts of gold and silver. When the Bible talks about his wealth with respect to silver, it was beyond counting. They don't even attempt to list. It was so much. And bronze, even in those days, would have been valuable. It was so plenteous, it's not even mentioned. We know that the bronze laver, that was in front of the temple that was made of enormous oxen and a bowl in which they washed the priests. It would sit from about here to the other side and to the front. That would have been how large it was. Everything was enormous. Everything was, shall we say, today over the top. And that was an exhibition of his wealth and God's blessing on him. So common that it's just like rocks. And he makes the point here in even that same verse talking about cedar and sycamore. Sycamore tree is just, at that time, was just common. Cedars themselves, Israel did not have cedars. The cedars came down out of Lebanon. Do you know how they got the cedars to build the temple? They floated them down the Mediterranean in large flotillas. Even that technology really is beyond a lot of the technologies of the day for being able to complete that. So, yes, Solomon was extremely influential. Israel would be positioned uniquely to spread this influence because of where they existed geographically. They were over a major trade route, so everything going into Africa and Europe comes down through the Fertile Crescent, passes through their kingdom. He is setting up, and the point that you made, Jimmy, in the passage there, it talks about in verse 26, he gathered together chariots and all of these things. Now, he did all of those things. That was one specific thing he was told. All the kings of Judah were told not to do. God said, don't trade in chariots because they would come to rely on them as their source of power as opposed to relying on God. So what did Solomon ultimately learn? His experiences in verses 2, 10 through 11, his failings in 1 Kings 11, 1 through 4. All of these influence, you know, points of his wisdom. 1 Kings 2, 18 through 19, I want to back up and look at that because it talks about his reflections. 1 Kings 2, 18 and 19. Actually, I think I've got a passage out of place there. I apologize. That's not right. His reflections in Ecclesiastes talk about it specifically, you know, about the whole duty of man is fear God and keep his commandments. Style of the book, and I'm going to try and hurry through parts of this. The style of the book is an introduction in chapter 1, 1 through 6. Short subjects in 1, 9 through 18. miscellaneous proverbs in 10 through the end of the book. If we look at styles of construction used, and this was insightful for me in looking at the construction of the proverbs, and as we study the book, we won't focus on this, but I think it is interesting to look at things that are pointed out. Equivalence. Where no oxen are, the clean's crib. Well, if there's nobody there to mess it up, if there's those kids in the room, they're not going to mess it up. Okay? Paradox. A soft tongue breaketh bone. Well, that you wouldn't think that a soft tongue could break anything. That's a paradox. It's making you think about it. We know phrasing of that as the pen's mightier than the sword from a modern-day comparison. Soft answer turns away wrath is another example of one of the proverbs that we'll study. Similarity. As an earring of gold and an ornament of fine gold, so is the wise reprover upon an obedient ear. So, similar things. And the similarity here is what? Value. It's the value that's similar. It's of high value. Absurdity. Of what use is money in the hand of a fool, since he has no desire to get wisdom? You know, there's a proverb that says a fool and his money are soon parted. This is the example of the absurdity here, is that what use is it to give a fool money if he's not going to use it wisely, if he's just going to lose it? Styles of constructions on consequences. Whoever digs a pit will fall into it. You know, a man that fires a shot, you know, in a war is going to create something of which there's going to be consequences. When we spread lies or rumors about somebody, there's going to be consequences. So if you dig a pit, you know, somebody's going to fall into it. If you start a rumor, somebody's going to be harmed by it. Those are examples of consequences. Commit your works unto the Lord, and thy thoughts shall be established. And this is a positive example. So you're doing a positive thing, which is committing your works to the Lord, and as a result, you're going to be established. Relative value. A poor man is better than a liar. Okay. I think we've heard that in different forms, is that, you know, if we look at it, our reputation is something that's hard to earn but can be lost in an instant. You know, it's better to tell the truth than to be associated with being a liar, because you're no longer trustworthy. So if I'm going to lie and cheat and steal to have influence, the point that this proverb is making is that it would be better for me to be poor. When the Bible talks about if your eye offends you, what does it say? Pluck it out. That's kind of a comparison there on relative value. Your eye is extremely valuable. It's part of your body. But if it's going to cause you to sin, pluck it out. It's that comparison of relative value. Parallelism. Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. Now, this is an example of using parallels to emphasize the message. So, pride is destructive. Haughty spirit is essentially being prideful. You know, if you have a haughty spirit, you're liable to have a fall as well. So it's using that to parallelism between two sayings that essentially emphasize the same point. Numerical patterns. Three things are too wonderful for me, four I do not understand. And this one's harder for me to follow, so I'm not going to try to explain this one thoroughly, but an example of it is in Proverbs 30, 18 through 19. But it makes the point that, you know, there's numerical aspects to certain proverbs that you kind of repeat. Obviously, tried to use several different sources for looking at how to break up the proverbs so that we can kind of think through them. These are just some ways of how standard proverbs are written, how they're broken down, and how one can see the different patterns between them. Because styles of how a proverb are written also sometimes can be tie them to certain authors. And that pretty well concludes the introduction to Book of Proverbs. What questions do you have as we conclude for this morning on what you see the value of the Book of Proverbs to you? Now, I'm going to ask lots of questions in the auditorium class because that's my nature. So, might as well get comfortable to go ahead and just speaking up. Jeffrey, what do you find insightful about Proverbs? It's the simplicity of it. The simplicity of just the basic application. The benefits of making it easy to remember. That's the thing that I find helpful. In our modern day, if we're looking at this, who we would attribute Proverbs to, in the United States history, who is associated with having written lots of, shall we say, Proverbs? Benjamin Franklin. If you look at his writings, many of his writings are biblically based, taking some of these proverbs and applying them. For example, a penny saved is a penny earned is a transition of a biblical proverb to a more modern application. Thoughts and comments. As we get into the study, we will cover a number of topics. Our next topic, and it's on your sheet because I didn't keep one of them. What's the next lesson? Fear of the Lord. It's the starting point because it's the theme. And we'll base our study off of that. And then as we look at all of the rest of the topics, we'll tie it back to that as well. Thank you for your attention, and I appreciate you today.